to Artery, with Robert Simpkins, a podcast on art, authorship, and anthropology. In each episode of this collaborative podcast, one anthropologist, specializing in a particular cultural context, has a conversation with an artist of their choosing, exploring issues of authorship and relational creativity in art. In this episode, Zuhanshu, an anthropologist working on art, body movement and health, speaks with artist Asimino Kremels. I will now hand over to Zuhan to introduce herself and her guest. Enjoy.
Welcome to this episode. My name is Zuhanshu, and I am a medical and multimodal anthropologist working on arts and improvisation, body movement and mobility, and health and well-being. Today, I'm joined by Asimino Kremels, a multidisciplinary artist and dance improviser with over 30 years of experiences in dance making. While living in Chicago during the 2000s, before the selfie was in full bloom, she engaged in a daily movement practice incorporating self-videography. She revived this practice during the COVID-19 pandemic, creating quarantine dance practice diaries. Through this project, I was introduced to Asimino and her artwork. Hello, Asimino. Could you please introduce yourself to our listeners?
Greetings, everyone, and thank you so much, Zihan, for this opportunity. I'm speaking to you today from my home in Philadelphia. Some people know me as a dance artist. Others are familiar with my improvised needlework and crochet art. And some people know me as an arts administrator. I work independently outside of formal institutions or settings. I pretty much live on the margins and in the interstitial spaces of the arts and culture sphere here in the U.S.
Thanks for joining us. So can you tell us about how you started making art? And perhaps was there a particular moment when you started to consider yourself as an artist?
When I was in elementary school, I sold a painting. It was a rainbow done in acrylics with soft sculpture clouds affixed to the canvas. So maybe that was the beginning of my being an artist. I actually haven't sold any paintings since then. But I began to focus in a very disciplined way on my dance training as a young person, and I identified as a dancer for a really long time. But sometime around when I was in college, maybe in like the late 80s, early 90s, I realized that I had to proclaim an identity that was more authoritative than dancer. So I started calling myself performance artist. But I'm just not sure really about labels. I think that I've always made things and had what people would call an artist point of view, but I don't think there's a particular point in time when I recognize this.
Then how would you describe your role as an artist now? Has your relationship towards your artwork changed over time?
So I was thinking about this, and I kept coming up with the word diffuse, that I feel like I've become more diffuse as an artist, more spread out and less specifically concentrated on any particular one area or thing. And my explorations are more process oriented, and I haven't really been producing a lot of products so much lately. For my all over physical training and practice, I've been studying Aikido, which is a martial art, for the past 10 years or so. Really recently, I started a weekly outdoor dance meetup in my neighborhood to practice flocking, which is a way of moving together as a group the way birds or fish do. And I have a textile practice. And I used to do a lot of freeform crochet with hook and yarn. Now I freeform with embroidery with needle and thread on fabric. And I'm also engaging a lot with computers and online material. A whole lot more. A couple years ago, I got a high-powered secondhand laptop so I could take an online class with Lajoune McMillan, who's a new media artist that works with motion capture. And a lot of it was pushing the edge of my technical abilities. But I came to realize that there's so much creativity that is going on in virtual spaces, and the screen literally becomes a window into people's imaginations. So in the past year or so, I've been trying to learn how to use digital tools more, specifically things like Photoshop. I've always drawn and made designs, so now I'm learning how to translate these skills into digital media. And also, I think what's really changed a lot is that I've aged. And that is a whole journey in itself, a kind of surprising experience of the body in flux and starting to feel like a different person entirely. And then finally, I wanted to share that because of the work that I do helping other artists fill out applications for funding, I think a lot about the economics and cultural circumstances that go into the idea of the artist's identity as a member of society. So I think that saying that I'm an artist is a convenient label for someone like me, but it can also lead to a lot of confusion, and people have so many different ideas of what an artist is.
That's very thought-provoking, especially the questioning of artist as a label and also the distinction between process-oriented and product-oriented art making. So I was wondering if you could tell me more about one of your recent works or practices, Quarantine Dance Practice Diaries.
Yeah, so during the pandemic, so many of us were afraid of being together in public space, and I started to really miss performing in front of an audience. So I began making videos of myself dancing in the house I was living in at the time, kind of similar to what I had done like a decade or so before. Just dancing with a small camera and then videotaping myself and then looking at it afterwards and then sharing it with other people online. But I started to realize it was a way of companioning myself, and especially companioning myself through my aging process, just observing my body and what it could do and what it couldn't do and what I wanted it to be able to do and what it wasn't doing, and also new interesting things it was doing. So, you know, it became a very interesting kind of self-reflective practice. You know, I do have people that follow me online and, you know, who had a look and gave me feedback. I was part of a group at the time that was an artist support group that was more kind of a professional careerist support group. And none of the other people in the group were dancers. And so they looked at my video, but they said they wanted to understand more about what I was doing. So someone suggested I do a voiceover. And I thought that was a really interesting idea. So I would make my video and then I would replay it for myself, and I would narrate what I was thinking about seeing myself. That's how the format got established.
And how did you prepare for this piece during quarantine? As a dance improviser, would you say that the process was mostly improvisational, or was there also some element of choreography?
Pretty much completely improvised. I think that the word choreography can mean so many things these days. But I think that in the way that you're using it, you're asking, like, did I have planned movements or like specific things I knew I was going to do in front of the camera? And the answer to that is no. I think that the choreography is basically like, where is the camera in the room and how big is the room and what am I wearing and what's possible within this situation, this frame?
This reminds me that even what we call an improvisational dance piece is still to some extent choreographed improvisation, because it is planned on other aspects of art making, like the positioning of the camera, as you mentioned. And that leads to my next question. Self-videography seems to be a very important element in this piece. So how would you describe your relationship with the camera in your practice?
The camera is a way of creating another organ of perception in the room in a way. Like there's my own perception, what I'm seeing through my own eyes and feeling through my own proprioception. And then having this other organ of perception in the room, even if it's a mechanical one, it creates a kind of orientation. There's a way when dancing, if we know we're being observed by someone or something, we orient ourselves in a certain way. And I think it's part of the skill of a dancer to finesse this kind of orientation. And that orientation is directional, and it's also proximal. So a person in a room with a camera, especially if the person placed that camera there themselves, then that camera is an extension of their own perception. So in a way, it's like having a body part that you can take off and set in the corner of the room. And then you dance with it, but you can also pick it up. And as you move, you know, it's like having an eye in your hand. If you're holding it in your hand, if you put the camera on top of your head and you walk in a line, the camera will perceive the ceiling or the sky from the point of view of the top of your head. So I think it's really fun to play with this idea of perception through the camera. I mean, the camera is an eye, and it's also kind of an ear because it can also pick up the audio, these video cameras that we use with our phones or the screen laptop cameras that we have. It's interesting to understand, like, I think we don't realize like how fast the world goes by us. Like, you know, if I turn my head to look in a certain direction, the whole field of perception will move very quickly. All I have to do is turn my head like an inch, but it's like this sweep of the visual field just going whoosh. And you can really see that when you hold the camera in your hand and just move it like a little bit of an inch. And all of a sudden, you know, you have this very quick movement of vision, like from one corner of the room to the other. And it's just a whole other rhythm. And yeah, it's like the secondary vibrations of everything that we do comes into view in a kind of interesting way.
I really like the way that you perceive the camera as an extension of your bodily perception and sort of develop a playful relationship with it. So in a way, it becomes part of your movement practice as well. And then I was wondering, after the recording, you also reviewed and edited the videos, right? Can you tell us more about this process?
Yeah, it's pretty straightforward. I'm not a super sophisticated video editor, although I would like to become one. When I was making the videos in Chicago, I had a Mac with iMovie, and I was getting really, really facile with that. But then I stopped doing video for, you know, 10 years or something. And now, so for the quarantine practice diaries, I just used really simple software that I got online. So that I could do things like trim the edges off if I wanted, or splice things together, make the voiceover, you know, pretty straightforward, just technically reviewing it, talking about it, editing it, putting it together.
One thing that really stood out to me was your voiceover. For example, your voiceover goes like this.
Here, I thought I would kind of play around with this perspective of looking at the body from the bottom. The camera's at my feet, almost as if I would be standing on the camera. And I just thought, well, what's possible here? I didn't feel like there was a lot. Then I thought I'd try again.
This is just an example from the quarantine dance practice diaries. And I'm curious about the process of reviewing and talking about your own bodily movement. What was it like? Did it create a new relationship with yourself? Perhaps like a way of reflecting on or companioning yourself, as you mentioned earlier.
to make a video and then replay it. So that's layering time over time. So yeah, it's like selves interacting with each other over time. So when I watch the video, I'm watching my past self, even if it's just my past self from 20 minutes ago. And I'm commenting on that self. I can watch myself from inside and describe what I'm experiencing. Like, for example, right now I'm sitting here, I'm sitting on the floor. I've got the laptop in front of me in a small table, and I'm holding my toes with my hands. I can feel that my toes are a little bit cold, and I can see, you know, the outline of your head on the screen in front of me. I can do that kind of reporting from inside my experience, but you know, it's a reflection of a self. Obviously, I can't smell myself. I can't, you know, there are certain things that the video doesn't transmit, but there are things happening outside the screen that might not show up, or that definitely won't show up. So, you know, it occurs to me it might be really interesting now to review some of the Chicago pieces and do a voiceover from my current state that I'm in now, and do a voiceover for those pieces that I did 10 years ago. I don't know if you did this, but so many people have family albums, or they do slideshows or films, or they look at images of themselves or their families from when they were little kids, and the family gets together and they talk about what they're seeing while they're seeing it, you know? It's kind of like doing that with yourself, just one-on-one. and, you know, my audience, sometimes I know, you know, who is going to look at. I have actual, like, real social relationships with the people that are going to look at the material. And then sometimes, like you, there'll be just someone who found it online and doesn't. I hadn't met them before. So it's an interesting kind of relationship with the audience, with other people, that allows for some surprise.
So in a sense, you are engaged in a relationship not only with these multiple layers of yourself, but also with other people like your audience. Am I right? That's very interesting, especially in the context of self-isolation. Can you tell us more about this? Who is your artwork made for?
I really believe in this idea that the artist themselves is the first recipient of the artwork. I do mostly create my artwork out of a need that I have myself, but I don't live alone on the top of a mountain. You know, I live in a society. I also exist in online contexts. So there's just kind of a hope that what I am doing and what I'm interested in will also be interesting to other people. There are some people who talk about, you know, the more like I forget what the exact saying is, but it's something like the personal is universal or something. Like, the more specifically that we can drill down to our authentic individual experience, the more likely it is that other people will be able to sort of relate and resonate with it because of our common human situations. So I think I do rely something on that principle, but I'm not interested in figuring out, like, oh, I create work for these kinds of people, or I create work for those kinds of people, or this is my specific audience that, you know, I want to speak to. Partially, you know, because I'm making work outside of a marketplace in a way. So, you know, I don't know who will resonate with it. But it's so marvelous when people do, and it gives an opportunity to, you know, discuss and think together more about our situation as people in this world, in this time, what we're experiencing, what we're going through, what our lives are like. I would say that specifically the voiceover, since it was suggested by specific people that were part of my artist group, I kind of made it for them in a way. I made it for those like four or five people. And then, you know, it found a little bit of a wider audience later.
Can you share more about this, like your interactions with these 405 people? How do they influence your creative practice?
I think that dance as an art form, especially dance that is not in a recognizable genre like, I don't know, tap dance or ballet or something, people feel uncertain about it. They don't encounter experimental dance every day. So, you know, they wanted to have some deeper understanding of what was going on. They felt that they needed more context. And I can understand that. So the context that I gave was like very personal context, like what the context was for me in the moment, kind of letting them into my own thought processes as a dance artist, not so much giving them context like, well, you know, I studied with Simone Forti or, you know, certain kinds of people that might not have had much interest for them. But to hear my own voice describing my own feelings and observations about what I'm doing, I think gives a kind of context that's very, it seemed like it was very engaging. And it was interesting for me too. So again, you know, I think that the artists themselves, like their own interest and enthusiasm level for what they're doing is the thing that really translates. Perhaps more than something else that might be going on.
This brings us to a new project you're preparing, the Screen Buddies Practicum, where you're also translating your own creative explorations into practices designed for a wider participant. But before moving on, I'd like to play a short sound clip that you created for it, featuring your experimentation with recording moving fingers on the keyboard and also breathing and sounding. Thank you, Asimina, for making this sound clip for this episode. So I was wondering if you could tell us more about the process of making it and how does it relate to the Screen Buddies Practicum?
So this idea to make this little sound clip was a wonderful preparation for me to think about the types of assignments that Shannon and I will give to participants in the Screen Buddies Practicum. To make this sound clip, what I did was I put my fingers on the keyboard of my computer and also my mouse. And I really tried to tune in to the sensation of touching the keys and touching the mouse and the kind of experience of listening to the sounds that come out of the machine when I click the mouse and click the keys and how that feels in my body. It's almost like playing a musical instrument, like turning the mouse and the keyboards into a piano or something. And then my idea was to record breathing and to record keyboard sounds as kind of just a very simple metaphor of like the body and the laptop together, you know. And then the very interesting discovery that I made was that in order for the recording to sound like it felt to interact with this, I had to slow it down. So it just made me think about the speediness of digital media and the quick, you know, the quick response of the keys and the mouse as little mechanical devices. And then just like the slower reverberations of that experience into our bodies, which are these fleshy, watery, you know, cellular things. So that was a really big discovery. And it's this type of just spending time with touch and small movements that is one of the exercises that I think that we'll be doing in this Green Bodies practicum to start out.
Then can you tell us more about the Green Bodies practicum? Where does your inspiration for this project come from?
For a while, I've been thinking that, you know, I want to be more in a position of like teaching and exploring and sharing some of the things that I've been thinking about as an artist over the years. And I've been looking for situations in which I can do that. And since I'm not affiliated with any specific institutions, I'm not a professor, I don't teach in any dance studios, I kind of need to come up with those contexts by myself. And actually, when you contacted me out of the blue and expressed interest in what I was doing, that really was very nourishing for me, because it was like, oh, here's somebody who's interested in thinking about these things that I'm also interested in thinking about. And it was such an invitation for me to think more deeply about what I'm already thinking about in terms of the use of the frame, the use of the body. And I think that what was really interesting about your response and your dancing is the way that you really seem to zone in on empathy and feeling and a kind of tenderness that there really is like another person on the other side of that screen. And I feel like you are really reaching for a connection to my dancing in a way that was through your own body to extend the feeling and the exploration that I had started and take it on as your own and continue it. And you introduced me to some articles that people had written in, you know, fields of dance and different kinds of anthropological scholarship about the screen and the moving body. And I thought, wow, this is great. I am also really interested in thinking about these things. And wouldn't it be fun to create a practicum where we could sort of share what I'm thinking and also create a context for students in the practicum to also read these articles, for us to discuss them, for me to propose certain kinds of activities that would further my own research and my own interests in this kind of interacting with the screens and the cameras, and then also give other artists a chance to try and create their own works with this knowledge and information. So that's what we're doing. And I recruited Shannon Brooks, who's a young artist here in Philadelphia, who also is a filmmaker, to be my assistant and help me kind of gather everything together. So I'm really excited about this opportunity that we're going to create for other people. And there's a choreographer here in Philadelphia named Leah Stein that I danced with years ago, who has a studio and a nonprofit dance company that is an organization that is going to present this practicum.
That's fascinating. It was very nourishing for me as well, because your artwork has long been a source of inspiration for my anthropological thinking. And at that time, I was working on my MPhil research on bodies in lockdown, especially how dance improvisers draw sensory resources into their self-care practices in playful, subjunctive, and experimental ways. And when I came across your work, I just had the urge to dance with your video diaries, because you were dancing during self-isolations and your experiences were to some extent inaccessible, but I really want to understand you. So I made a video essay about it to really empathize with you and speculate upon your experiences through my own body. And that's why you found scenes like this in my video essay.
I'm really interested in the kind of dance that you can see from super close. Not just far away on the stage.
Here I was kind of reenacting your movement and voiceover alongside you. But that was initially for research purpose. And I didn't expect that our conversation would also become one of the sources of inspiration for you to create a new art project. So it's just very interesting to see how anthropologists and artists can inspire each other.
Yeah, I mean, I think that one of the things that I'm always interested in is not just the art, but the conditions under which the art is made. So, and I feel like the conditions under which the art is made are very evident in the art. So there's a place there for anthropology and creative work to overlap.
This reminds me that you describe yourself as a multidisciplinary artist, right? So do you draw ideas from various sources and then combine them? How would you describe your process of finding inspiration?
I call myself a multidisciplinary artist, not so much an interdisciplinary artist, although I try to notice how the ways of thinking that I have are that I apply the same ways of thinking across the board, no matter what kind of media I'm engaged in. I'm always kind of looking for that unified field theory. But I also think that there is divergence at the same time in the different media that I work with. You know, I had a really interesting experience a really long time ago when I was taking a printmaking class. We were doing a kind of printmaking on a piece of metal where you etch a piece of metal with your design, and then you put this very thick, waxy ink on the metal, and then so that it will get in the grooves that have been created in the metal by your etching. And then you have to wipe all the ink off except the ink that's in the grooves, right? So you put this thick layer of ink, it's thick, it's like shoe polish or something, on your metal plate, and then you have to wipe it down with circular motions until everything is gone except for the ink that's in the little grooves. Then you flip it over and you put it through a press and the ink squeezes out of the grooves and onto the paper, and then you have your etching. But I was learning this process, and the process of wiping the extra ink off the plate was this kind of time-consuming thing with this circular motion. And I was doing it, and then I remember I was in between stages. I was waiting for some process to happen with the chemicals or something like that. And I started dancing in the studio, and I started walking in a square and doing this circular motion with my hand as if I was wiping the plate. And I didn't even know what I was doing at first. Like, it just came up from my body. And of course, the square shape was a reflection of the border of the plate that I had been wiping. It wasn't a square, it was a rectangle. But anyway, so I had embodied this process on this multi-level, right? Like, my body was remembering this, and it was kind of like acting out a demonstration. So that was really instructive for me. You know, it just made me realize like how our body learns. Our brain, you know, that's in our head has a lot of different like little quick ideas zipping around. That's more like the digital world. But our nervous system, you know, comes down from our brain through our spines and out to the tips of our fingers and the tips of our toes through our nervous system. And it's always learning things and absorbing things. And then it also re-expresses those things out. And, you know, this is how we are. I realized, you know, we're absorbing, we're learning, we're recording, and then we're expressing. I feel like expressing is really part of our process of digesting our experience and making room for new experience to come in. So I think that there's definitely a space with this. I'm not even sure if I'm answering your question anymore, but I think that, you know, the Screen Bodies workshop is going to be an opportunity for us to kind of like express and move through all this information we've been like soaking in through our interaction with these internet-enabled screens and cameras.
Sure, you are answering my questions, of course. Yeah, because you're talking about how techniques from one art form can be translated into another.
Yes. Right.
Especially through your own body, like training and learning or a kind of instilling through your body.
Yeah. And I feel like, I mean, my very, very earliest training in dance was in creative movement and in ballet. And ballet is very geometric. It relies a lot on platonic geometry. I feel like, you know, when I do my needlework, there's also a lot, you know, a stitch is basically a line, right? A line has a direction. So you make a stitch and then you have this little line and then you can decide like, well, what is the next direction that you're going to go? If you are working improvisationally, which is how I like to do. And I feel like, you know, that's happening in dancing too, where you make a movement, the movement has an orientation in the room, it has a direction in space, you know, and then either consciously or unconsciously, we make a decision to then move from that, from there, you know, to another position. Although, you know, movement is much more fluid and it doesn't have these little, you know, the body has continuity in a way that the digital world does not. And I'm really interested in that disconnect or that coexistence of the continuity and the discontinuity. I mean, I haven't been able to dance in a way that's discontinuous because I can't disappear, can't jump out of my body. I mean, I guess I maybe spiritually I could, but my body will still be there. You know, it, again, there's the audience. The audience will see you. Like if you fall asleep on stage, you might think that you're like floating around in outer space, but the body will see it as the audience will see an asleep person on the stage. So, but then when we're working with digital media, there's this flickering and this turning of a continuous view into all these little pixels. And, you know, after we finish this talk, I'll say goodbye and I'll click a button and you'll disappear. And, you know, it's a very strange thing.
And then those inspirations you've sucked in through your own body, how do they develop into an art project? Do they just naturally express themselves, as you mentioned?
Well, I think I've been thinking about a lot of these things for a really long time. So they're just there. They're just kind of, you know, they're in my mind. They're on my mind. They're waiting for an opportunity to be expressed and shared and for us to try things out. In terms of screen bodies, there's really no new artworks yet. You know, I think that artworks will come out of it. The screen bodies will have opportunities for us to do improvisational scores and try things out. And, you know, we might consider those scores to be artworks. You know, right now I'm thinking, I wonder what kind of score we could come up with to explore this, like, continuity of embodied experience versus the discontinuity of the screen. It'll be fun to figure out. I think that the idea of inspiration is interesting. I mean, I really believe that, you know, the world, the whole of phenomena is just this like constant flow of like create things are coming into being and then, you know, kind of dissolving. So as artists, I feel like we don't so much create things ourselves as we join in an ongoing process. So I'm interested in figuring out how to join in this ongoing process and have fun with that.
I'm also quite curious about other people involved in this project, such as your assistant Shannon. What role does she play and what does it mean to create as a group?
So Shannon is helping me sort of put the wheels on the ground. So it's not just so much talking and getting excited, but actually, like, you know, setting a date and a time and a place for us to actually like get down to work and really start working on these things. But Shannon is also a dancer and also a filmmaker. So she has a lot of resources and a lot of thinking that she's already been doing about the body and the camera, the body and the screen. So she is playing an administrative role and also sort of a co-artistic role.
So in this co-artistic relationship, how do you collaborate with each other? For example, in your preparation sessions, how do you discuss ideas and develop scores or exercises?
We talk about things, and I share, for example, the articles that you shared with me that people have already written about their experiences with embodiment and screens. And Shannon also has a whole playlist that she wants to create of artworks that are done by filmmakers that she thinks are resonant with this. And then in terms of developing scores, we meet together in the studio and start moving. We brought our laptops and we brought our phones and we put them in the middle of the floor of the rehearsal hall. And we started, you know, dancing and exploring, and we noticed that we had to plug things in, and we realized that the power pack that's on the cord for the computer is so heavy. Like, why is it so heavy? when we plug the computer in, what is it plugging into? What are all the kind of what is it like to move holding a phone with your eyes closed for 10 minutes? You know, and really feel the weight of that object and how you accommodate the whole rest of your body to be holding on to this thing, which is so not ergonomic, right? These little flat, slippery things. Or, you know, what if I do some emailing for 20 minutes and Shannon just observes my body and how I form myself to engage in the emailing? You know, what would she learn? You know, what would I learn if every once in a while she came over and just sat behind me and put her back against my back? Just remind me that I have a spine while I'm engaged in an email. You know, there are things like that that we want to try.
That's very exciting. Do you also capture or record these experiences and then perhaps transform them into scores and exercises?
Yes, that we're in the process of doing that. And I think that that's kind of a model of how I think the screen bodies practicum itself is going to evolve. We want to make sure that we record all of the meetings as best we can. There will be a lot of eyes in the room, human eyes and electronic eyes. We're also thinking about what happens if, for example, the internet goes out, and what contingencies will we have for the people who are remote so that they can continue their synchronous practice with us, even if we're not able to connect through the screen? You know, what is this idea of relationship over vast amounts of space? We can say it's difficult to feel the presence of another body if they're not within a certain proximity of us, but, you know, can we push the limits of our sense in terms of understanding that? So it's going to be really interesting. And in between these 1 month sessions, Shannon is setting up a Discord channel so that people can continue to share their experiments in between our meetings. And we're also setting up a Google Drive where we're dropping a bunch of resources and articles for people to read and things for people to look at in between.
It seems to me that this project has so many layers and aspects, which also raises the question of authorship. In collaborative art making, how do you navigate authorship?
This is a really good question that's been asked over the years. We are in a place in history where our interdependence is starting to become more well recognized. There are complex contexts in which each of us is functioning. And we get ideas from all kinds of things, human things, non-human things, experience, you know, anything that we experience through our nervous system can spark some kind of like elaboration or creative addition. I think that assigning authorship, part of it has to do with who does the work, you know, who actually like spends time actually doing whatever the labor is of a particular project. And then in terms of crediting sources and things like that, I think that maybe when presenting a work to an audience, it's really nice to take a moment to create a project history, even just for oneself, and to think like, okay, this project was sparked by this. I remember this happened. I remember that happened. But we won't always be able to remember everyone who contributed to our process. So authorship is slippery. But it's nice to be able to know who you can talk to if you like something, right? So there's a function to authorship that just helps us create a relationship with another human being.
Now, as we move on to the final part of this episode, I'd like to take a moment to explore your artistic journey as a whole. If we look back on the two projects we discussed today, it's interesting to see how they share similar ideas, but also move in different directions. And I remember from your website that you mentioned not only creating art yourself, but also teaching and guiding other people's creative process. So how would you describe the relationship between these two roles? Do you think that creating is very different from teaching, or is it more of a combined practice for you?
There's overlaps. You know, I mean, I don't think I can really teach. I mean, I think we can teach each other technical skills or techniques that they can use in their art making. I mean, I've been identifying as an artist or some artist adjacent type of being for a really long time now, and I've gained some experience. So I'm really interested in working with other people. I think most artists really enjoy having some kind of witness to their process. I know I do. I really love getting in the studio with someone and having them show me something they're working on. And if they want feedback or if they have a certain like creative problem that they're trying to figure out, I love being able to talk with them about it and maybe offer some resources to help them move forward or develop or evolve in what they're doing. It's just fun. I mean, I think that human beings are very creative no matter what way they identify. And that's a very delightful aspect of being a human being. I think it's just so exciting when people create their own anything, you know, you know, each individual person is so unique and has a perspective unlike any other person. And I'm just pleased to support people in their making of whatever they want to make. And by extension, that encourages me and gives me ideas for, you know, things I want to make.
Over the past 30 years, you've also created both in-person and online pieces. So how do these different spaces relate to your creative practice?
I had a really nice breakthrough when I realized that, you know, I didn't have to be limited to any particular type of space or place to be dancing. Movement as an art form is very broad. Someone in any state of being, no matter what their capacity or limitations, if they can move something, some part of their body, then they can do that in a way that is playful or expressive. And I realized, oh, this is great. You know, I will always continue to be able to do dance as long as I want to. And by extension, you know, any particular space or place can be a place to dance.
Then how about time? When reflecting on your journey as an artist, how have your ideas and practices evolved over time? Have you noticed any pacing or like temporal dynamics at play?
Well, I was thinking about this question and I realized that because I work mostly in a process orientation and less as a product orientation, the idea of developing an idea over time is kind of a hard thing to answer. I mean, there are times when if I'm making an object, I'll be working on it. And then at some point I'll be like, okay, this looks like it's complete, you know, or I'm not interested in it anymore or something. And then it's done. And that could have taken an hour or like 3 months. But then the next time I start to make something, I'm picking up from where I left off. So there's this kind of like long arc of development. And, you know, a lot of times I think about how, you know, we look at a flower and we say, oh, that flower, it's like, you know, it's like the ultimate expression of this plant is this flower. But why? You know, we could say the ultimate expression is the seed because it's so potent and it has like all this information in this perfect tiny little space to make another flower or another whole plant, you know? So I have a hard time thinking about things in terms of like their completed development because I don't really know, you know?
For these artworks that are, in a sense, always in the making, do you feel a sense of responsibility for them? What is the responsibility as an artist and creator?
You know, the question of an artist's responsibility, I think, is sort of contingent on their context, what kind of shift they're trying to make in themselves and what kind of shift they might be trying to make in the world. You know, actions have consequences. And what, you know, what are the consequences of a certain action? So my responsibility as an artist, I think, is to keep nourishing my own creative practice and to nourish other people's creative practice. I really just value creative thinking and nonconformist behavior, gentle nonconformity. Yeah, because I feel like, you know, we need to be creative in order to survive and also to enjoy, you know, to enjoy our lives.
This is such a perfect place to wrap up this episode. Thank you, Asmina, for this wonderful conversation. It's been truly nourishing and also quite playful. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. It was really an honor.
This was Artery with Robert Simpkins, a podcast on art, authorship, and anthropology, supported by the UK Arts and Humanities Research Council. Hope to speak with you again soon.